Penultimate talk on history given by Steve Coleman, and the title, which is
the historical place of the SPGB.
Right.
Okay. Well, some of you will have heard of what Herbert Butterfield criticised as being what he called the Whig interpretation of history. And it has, he asserted, and I quote, often been an obstruction to historical understanding because it has been taken to mean the study of the past with direct and perpetual reference to the present. Through this system of immediate reference to the present day, historical personages can easily and irresistibly be classed into the men who furthered progress and the men who tried to hinder it. So that a handy rule of thumb exists by which the historian can select and reject and make his points of emphasis. Now, what Herbert Butterfield is rightly condemning is the approach to history which sees all of the events of the past as part of an inevitable process leading to the present. Now, I shall have more to say about historical inevitability in the next lecture, but it will do to point out now that any historian who can only perceive the past in terms of the present is not only a bad historian in the sense that his bias towards the present distorts his feel for the atmosphere of the past, but worse than that, he is a fundamentally conservative historian because he allows past social developments to suggest to him an inevitable and inescapable path to the present. Now, the Marxist conception of history is not a theory of inevitable determinism according to a grand pattern of material development, although if you listen long enough to some vulgar Marxists, you'll think that it is. The history of all societies is the history of class struggle, as Marx said, and the outcome of class struggle is clearly not susceptible to dogmatic prediction. History is a story of people making choices, and sometimes they make what can be retrospectively seen as the wrong choice from the point of view of their own material class interest. The anarchists who helped bring the Bolsheviks to power in 1917 and were then thrown into prison. The German Jews who supported Hitler in the hope that their support would make him rethink his anti-Semitism. The freedom-seeking women who fought for the Ayatollah in Iran. Now, they may have been unforgivably stupid in having supported movements that were against their own interests, but the role of the historian is not to judge stupidity, in which case he would have to be making moral judgments all the time about what people are up to, but it is to examine what has happened and to try to explain why. So the two approaches to history conflict, and on the one side, the Whig interpretation judges where we have been from the point of view of where we are now, and on the other, the Marxist theory is concerned more with the dynamics of struggle and with how this changes things much more than with the contingent outcomes of those struggles. Now, what you might well ask, has any of this got to do with the historical place of the Socialist Party of Great Britain? Well, in fact, there is an important connection, because I would argue that the history of the organisation of the working class has suffered from what I have described and Butterfield described as Whig history writing. What I mean is that historians of the labour movement have traditionally divided political trends within the working class into those which are right and those which are wrong, practical or impractical, possibilist or impossibilist. And the right-thinking, practical, possible movements were those which became popular. And those which remained relatively unpopular are left to what Lenin described as the dustbin of history. Now, according to this theoretical Whiggism, the reformist, Methodist, trade unionist ILP, that's the Independent Labour Party, was destined to flourish, whereas the revolutionary, secularist, politically minded Social Democratic Federation was bound to fail. The Labour Party would inevitably succeed, it would inevitably catch on. The Socialist Party of Great Britain inevitably wouldn't. Marxism, it is dogmatically asserted by these Whig historians, was alien to the thought of British workers, as if inhabitants of the British Isles somehow evolved from the apes with a built-in adversity to the labour theory of value. Now, this process, whereby unpopular trends are ignored, is clearly dangerous and also dishonest. It partly stems from what somebody at Reading University, perhaps known to party members, has called the size fallacy. As he says in one of his papers, and I quote, "The historian of ideas does not judge the worth or interest of the theories of Plato by the number of Athenian votes he was able to muster, nor those of Rousseau by his following amongst the Genovese. The criteria applied are not those of the marketplace, where the huckster with the loudest voice attracts the most attention." Unquote. The size fallacy is part of the cause, then, of movements which are unpopular, which are not large, and which do not gain widespread support, being ignored. But another reason, I would contend, has been a conscious effort on the part of some historians who support the popular abuse of the term socialism, especially those who identify with the Communist Party, to ignore reference to ideas and organisations which don't fit into their comfortable and conservative beliefs about socialism. The way in which the Socialist Party of Great Britain has been ignored by historians must have involved some very strenuous manoeuvres on the part of a number of writers. G.D.H. Cole, for instance, the leading theoretician of the Fabian Society and one of the first able British Labour historians, mentions the Socialist Party only once in his History of Socialist Thought. But he mentions it was formed as a result of a breakaway from the Social Democratic Federation, which was led, a term he must have known to be inappropriate in the case of the party, by somebody called Fitzgerald. However, a few pages earlier, he mentions another Fitzgerald who led another breakaway from the SDF, only this time a right-wing breakaway. No indication is given, either in the text of the book or in the index, that the two Fitzgeralds are different men. And to add insult to injury, in his one reference to the party, Cole says that it was formed in 1903 instead of 1904. But maybe that's just one example that can be raised. So to look at another, Walter Kendall, in his The Revolutionary Movement in Britain 1900 to 1921, this contains one disparaging reference to the SPGB in the whole of a book dealing specifically with Marxist revolutionary ideas in Britain between 1900 and 1921. Now, you might wonder what else he found to put in the book, but the one reference to the SPGB is as a party unwilling to enter the political fray, even to the extent of adopting a programme of palliatives, retaining its political virginity only at the cost of failing to reproduce anything at all. Unquote. Now, the fact that Kendall was a member of the Labour Party may or may not have coloured his historical analysis. Another person, Henry Pelling, the Oxford Liberal academic, he has managed to studiously stay clear of the Socialist Party of Great Britain in all of his writings. Even when he's landed bang on top of it, he's made a point of moving elsewhere. But probably one of the most athletic feats of intellectual dishonesty surrounds the character of somebody who was a party member, T.A. Jackson, who was an early member of the party and a member of one of the first executive committees of the SPGB. Now, Jackson's awful poverty forced him to accept an offer from the ILP to be a paid speaker on their platform. His letter of resignation from the Socialist Party of Great Britain is a reminder of the indignity that poverty can sometimes bring. Despite still agreeing with the party, wrote Jackson, he would go, and I quote, "bleed the swines till I'm expelled." That's referring to the ILP. In fact, Jackson was not expelled from the ILP, but left in the 1920s to join the newly formed Communist Party. He became a leading speaker and theorist of the Communist Party, and later in life he wrote his autobiography called Solo Trumpet. In it, he manages to exclude mention of his SPGB membership, his association with the men who gave him his early ideas on Marxism, or his reason for becoming a reformist. So it's significant also that Jackson's daughter, who was in the party, married the famous Communist Party historian A.L. Morton, Yet when Morton wrote the entry for T.A. Jackson in the Dictionary of Labour Biographies published 2 years ago, no mention of the SPGB appears. So again, here we see a case of conscious dishonesty in relation to mention of the party. It's noteworthy that the only historian who has ever written a serious account of the Socialist Party of Great Britain was Chijiki Suzuki, who came from Japan. The reason for this is that Suzuki was relatively unbiased by the prejudices of British Labour historians, and he saw the Socialist Party of Great Britain for what it actually is, a very important aspect of working class politics in Britain and a tradition in its own right. Now, I'd now, or at least in a moment, want to turn to my own account of the tradition of which the Socialist Party of Great Britain is a part. But first, let me briefly summarise the conventional story of the evolution of the mainstream populist possibilist movement. Now, you'll remember that in the last talk I took the story up to the 1850s, Chartism had collapsed and the workers were without any political objectives at all. The new model unions had turned trade unionism into the reserve of the labour aristocracy, and strikes were very infrequent. The capitalist class, instead of beating down protest with sticks, were bribing the workers into submission with reforms. And the result of all this was a widespread acquiescence on the part of the working class to the capitalist system. It was for this reason that the formation of the International Working Men's Association in 1864, which Marx was a prominent participant in, was largely disregarded by British workers. It's true that some trade union leaders were on the executive committee of the First International, such as Howell, Applegarth, Odger and Creamer, but they were mainly interested in it as a means of defeating international blacklegging rather than as a political force for socialism. Incidentally, and I won't go into it, but as a force against international blacklegging, the First International was very successful. A very successful international trade union movement of the like that I think many people would agree hasn't been seen since. But at its formation, Marx, together with Weston, the famous citizen Weston of Value, Price and Profit, incidentally, and Le Loubet of France, were put on a subcommittee, so it's interesting that Marx was on a subcommittee of the EC with Weston, to draw up some rules for the international. The preamble to the rules were drafted by Marx, and I quote from them, that the emancipation of the working classes must be conquered by the working classes themselves, that the emancipation of the working classes means not a struggle for class privileges and monopolies, but for equal rights and duties and the abolition of all class rule. Now, most workers, however radical or even socialist they claim to be, did not accept Marx's statement that socialism means the abolition of classes as such. That's what he says in the preamble, and I think that puts the debate about the dictatorship of the proletariat into some perspective. He says it is not to do with class privileges or monopolies, but it is to do with the abolition of all class rule as such. But the majority of workers saw the gaining of concessions by the working class as being what socialism is about. And from 1864 to the present day, those who've called themselves socialists have traditionally accepted the one thing which every dot and comma of Marx's writings repudiates, and that is reformism. They have accepted the belief that socialism is not a system of society in which every social characteristic of capitalism is overturned, but that socialism is a trend within capitalism leading towards greater concessions to the working class. In the 1880s came what has been called by historians the socialist revival. Liberals, Fabians, trade union leaders, all convinced that the wages system was right and inevitable, began to devise programmes telling the capitalist class of Britain how to run the profit system. Then came the emergence of what Labour historians have called the new unionism. In the late 1880s, the unions became militant. But what was the nature of this militancy? They began to strike for more pay, they demonstrated to protest about the unemployed, they drew up political objectives, they even broke down the railings in Hyde Park and established it as a speaking place, for which we're eternally grateful. And there was plenty of movement within the working class. But if you stop to consider where it was going, you see that the militancy was fairly hollow. the victory of the match girls, the gas workers, the famous victory of the dockers in 1889, was followed by a period of unprecedented harshness from the employers. The dockers were all but destroyed as a union, certainly the stevedores were. The lockouts that began to appear in many parts of British industry, the use of police in order to break up picket lines throughout the early 1890s, this is the result of the new unionism, and trade unions had not gained much strength after the late 1880s, contrary to the popular belief. The traditional story of the 1890s concentrates on two things. Firstly, the efforts of the unions to free themselves from legal shackles, and secondly, the increasing realisation that an independent working class party was needed, which culminated in the formation of the Labour Party in 1906. Now, for the sake of brevity, and if anyone wants to develop this, they can later on in the discussion, I won't go into either of these processes, except to say that the Labour Party was never set up as a socialist organisation. From the start, it rejected Marx, it rejected materialism, it rejected the need for revolution. And an account of the birth of the Labour Party is given in the first article in the Socialist Standard series called Against the Left, which I think was published in August 1978. Now, having pointed out that there are two traditions of Labour history to be considered, the possibilist and the impossibilist, I now wish to turn to the origin and meaning of the political theory of impossibilism, of which the SPGB plays a crucial role. Now, I've got to say at the outset about this two things. One is that I might go on for a bit of a long time, in which case people can shout stop when they wish me to, because I'm going to refer to the text of a paper that I read at a seminar recently, and therefore it's a bit long. And the other thing I'm going to do is, you've got to appreciate, this is something I've been working on pretty well full time for just about over a year now, so if I get a bit boring or complex, you can tell me to move on. That having been said, I now want to look at the origin and meaning of the political theory of impossibilism. Okay, well, Marx was the first to point out that his theory couldn't be divorced from political practice. The problem is that even while he lived, Marx's theory meant different things and at different times to different people. The Marx who was said to have discovered the theory of class exploitation at the point of production and who advocated the abolition of the wages system as the revolutionary watchword of the working class was the opponent of a social system which, like all systems, could only be changed by removing all and not some of its features. This then was the revolutionary Marx. Then there was the Marx of the First International, who seemed in many ways to allow himself to be motivated, or at least involved, in economistic demands. And then there was the Marx who opposed Bakunin, who seemed, at least from some of the arguments he was putting against Bakunin, to be a statist. And also, of course, the Marx who advised the European workers to support the war against Russia because it would be a good thing for political democracy. Mm-hmm. There is also the Marx who, if certain scholars are to be believed, spoke through the mouth of Engels so that the two minds combined to become one Marx-Engels. Now, it's not my intention to contemplate which conflicting brand of Marxism was most genuinely held by Marx in the deepest corners of his mind, but to point out that there does exist a conflict of attitudes in Marx's political actions, which make it futile to suggest that Marxism is simply that which Marx said or did. This conflict is represented by his theory, which concerned a critique of a system, and his practice, which was sometimes applied to the abolition of the system as such, and at other times had different objectives, such as reshaping the system in a way that was likely to ameliorate the suffering of the working class, or a section of the working class. The former approach has been referred to by its opponents as Marxist purity or dogmatism, although it seems to me to be the basis of Marx's claim to being a scientific socialist. The conflict between purity or scientificity and practicability seems to have underlied most major theoretical disputes within the Marxist movement, so that you get Bernstein versus Marx, Lenin versus Martov, Marxists within the British Labour Party versus those outside of it. And it was this conflict of attitudes to the theory of socialism which led to the split in the Social Democratic Federation at the turn of the century. In 1884, the Democratic Federation committed itself to the objective of socialism. It then became the Social Democratic Federation. Previous to that, it had been an organisation comprising radicals and people who supported Irish independence, as well as some who were influenced by Marx. But it became a socialist organisation, and in so doing, it adopted a Marxist theory of class struggle, the belief in the need to dispossess a capitalist class, and for the subsequent creation of a system of common ownership of the means of wealth production, although it also spoke about a common ownership of a system of exchange. The Social Democratic Federation combined its advocacy of this theory with a number of moral and economic justifications of it, which were not Marxist, but their overall position comprised a synthesis of the lessons of Marxian political economy and also the rigour of English logic, which its leaders had picked up in the English public school system. Now, having found a theory, how were they to fulfil their political objective? And the root of the impossibilist-possibilist conflict lies in the answer to that question. Some members of the SDF argued that the logical completeness of their position would have to be sacrificed for the sake of winning workers to the cause. So palliatives were advocated, friendly links with trade unions were developed, election campaigns took place with the inevitable advocacy of something now rather than something when the objective conditions are ripe. Now, those who joined the SDF as radicals and had not been influenced by Marxist theory, and those who were won to the SDF by the kind of tactics I've mentioned, were happy to sacrifice theory for the sake of growth. But those who joined the SDF primarily because they were impressed by the inherent logicality of its revolutionary proposition saw the sacrifice of theory as little short of what they called reformist compromise. Now, that these two types of revolutionary socialist were clearly identifiable can be seen from the description of the SDF's membership contained in Guy Aldred's letter of application to the SPGB in November 1906. Very few people, I suppose, know that Guy Aldred actually did apply to join the SPGB, and it's something he kept very quiet about in later life. But he said this, and it was a very interesting point, which I think sums up what was going on in the SDF. He said, "I have got about a good deal amongst its rank and file during my membership, and I was surprised to find two distinct sets of feelings existing among its members. On the one hand, there were the frankly revolutionary spirits, good, earnest and sincere comrades. On the other, tame revisionist and mere social reformers. This being so, the organisation as such could have no policy and hence could not be class conscious." Now, the French socialist movement had begun its split over the same division of attitudes in 1881 when Paul Brousse led the opposition to the group represented by Jules Guesde and Paul Lafargue in the Federation of Socialist Workers of France. Rejecting the Guedist notion that the sole political objective of the working class should be the conquest of state power for the purpose of establishing socialism, Brousse advocated a programme of immediate reforms, and this policy became known as possibilism. The Belgian Socialist Party adopted the same programme, and it openly described itself as a possibilist party. The split which began to emerge in the SDF in 1900 was not simply the result of one section accusing the other of being impossibilist. That's a mistaken idea. On the contrary, it was a case of one section accusing the other one of possibilism and the latter retaliating by dismissing their original stance as impossibilism. That's an important difference in the between the standard explanation of what happened and what actually did happen. The move towards revisionism in the SDF was the consequence of political frustration. By 1901, H.M. Hindman, the founder of the SDF and its first Marxist advocate, had become tired of waiting for the revolution and retired from the Federation. Should be pointed out, Heinemann was a man who was a considerable property owner. He had been educated at Eton and then at Oxford. He had stumbled upon Marxist ideas, been rather discourteous to Marx in having printed a book copying a number of the ideas from Volume 1 of Capital and then not acknowledging any mention of Marx in the book. And this annoyed Marx intensely, and the two of them fell out. And he just got tired about the working class not facing up to the views that he saw as being absolutely logical. His letter of resignation from the SDF is revealing, so I'll quote it. 1. After so long a period of work on the executive, I wish to look at matters from the outside. 2. I fail to detect among the English workers that class consciousness and class antagonism, without which no good whatever can be done. Even the members of the SDF leave very much to be desired in this respect. As one of the highly educated, well-to-do class myself, I am quite astounded at the ignorance and apathy of my countrymen, and I am deeply discouraged at the result of our long-continued propaganda. 3. Under existing conditions, our only hope lies in successful political action. Yet the majority of our organisation seems wholly destitute of political aptitude. 4. I feel I have done all the good I can do in the detailed work of the organisation. When the workers at large or the members of the Social Democratic Federation rouse themselves in earnest and show a determination to deal effectively with the dangerous situation around us, I should be glad to make common cause with them in a vigorous attempt to relieve our country from the corrupt and incapable government by gang which now oppresses and degrades us, and to help to the best of my ability in the establishment of a cooperative commonwealth of organised socialism. Till then, I remain yours, fraternally, H.M. Heinemann. So it was a case of must try harder. In point 2, Heinemann reflects upon the inadequacy of working class ideas. In point 3, he derides our political aptitude. And in point 4, he offers his future services, but only if the members of the SDF and the working class as a whole will show more determination. The possibilists within the SDF responded to this cry of desperation by favouring more theoretical compromise. Their opponents, who were not particularly bothered about the fluctuating enthusiasm of members of the highly educated, well-to-do class, like Heinemann, responded by sticking more rigidly than ever to the logic of their principles. Now, the focus for the impossibilist-possibilist conflict came in 1900, with the establishment of the Labour Representation Committee, which, as most of you will know, was the committee set up by the trade union movement, comprising members of the SDF, the Fabian Society, the ILP, and also a majority of trade unionists, to decide on the formation of a general working class Labour Party. Now, it's true that few people in the SDF who were not to become impossibilists were much in favour of close unity with the Labour Representation Committee. Only the northern textile workers who joined the SDF via trade unionism were very optimistic about the prospect of the Labour Representation Committee, leading to the formation of a principled socialist party. Most members of the SDF, including the leadership, believed that it would be tactically unwise to sacrifice the independence of the Federation for the sake of building a mass Labour Party. But the impossibilists went further in their opposition to the Labour Representation Committee, claiming that trade union and parliamentary activity should be treated with great caution by socialists. Basing their case on the Marxist theory that in capitalist society workers are inevitably exploited, as well as a vague adherence to LaSalle's iron law of wages, which was in fact repudiated by Marx in Value, Price and Profit, but was only first published in English in 1898 and had possibly not been read by many of the impossibilists of the time. The impossibilists argued that socialists should keep their distance from those who merely sought to affect the rate of exploitation. Instead of desiring higher or fairer wages, the impossibilists urged trade unionists to campaign for the abolition of the wages system. The two aims were not, however, mutually exclusive. And of course, after the formation of the SPGB in 1904, the impossibilists modified their contempt for the limitation of what Marx had referred to as the industrial struggle. Nevertheless, they rejected absolutely the notion that a socialist party could be made up of men and women whose main concerns were with trade union wage bargaining and legislation. The possibilists, on the other hand, favoured closer association with the unions, believing that if socialists started out by supporting the trade unionists and their immediate demands, the trade unionists would end up supporting socialism. That was the idea. In fact, an Accrington delegate to the SDS Birmingham conference in 1901 suggested that it was the Federation's task to, I quote, permeate and capture trade unions. Now, on the issue of parliamentary activity, the impossibilists were quite opposed to the LRC's idea of sending Labour MPs to the House of Commons in order to ameliorate working class conditions under capitalism. And on this, I would refer anyone to an editorial entitled The Futility of Reform, published in the October 1904 issue of the Socialist Standard. It provides a very clear expression of the earliest view of the party on reforms. I think I'll read a bit of it. It's not getting too long, is it? First, these are the sort of points they were making. First of all, they say, any blue book dealing with any phase of working class life will show instances innumerable of the neglect of the local government. Incidentally, I'll stop myself in the middle and say you'll notice as I read it that a lot of these editorials were written by F.C. Watts, who was the first one on the first editorial committee of the Standard. F.C. Watts seemed to spend his time translating other socialist writers from French, and you'll notice a lot of French constructions in his writing are instances innumerable. He always seemed to put the adjective after the noun because he was so used to translating things. Anyway, he says, will show instances innumerable of the neglect of the local government board or of the borough councils or of the county councils in applying the laws already in existence. Housing Acts and Public Health Acts and Acts for the Prevention of Women Returning to Work after too early a period of after childbirth and Factory and Workshop Acts are not efficiently carried out, while powers vested in the governing bodies are hardly ever exercised. We have to point out further that sometimes a reform asked for by the working class can be granted to them without any serious danger to the capitalist class. In such cases, they make graceful concessions and the working class are usually asked to hail the party granting such a concession as their truest friend. Another case is sometimes a measure is passed which, while benefiting certain individual workers, proves disastrous to another larger section. And then they cite the Workmen's Compensation Act, which I won't go into. We are therefore forced to the conclusion that the trying to secure measures for the palliation of the evils of the existing class-governed society is useless. The men in control of the legislative, administrative and judicial machinery of the community can always dodge any such partial attacks upon their position, can always find loopholes to escape from any concession appearing to endanger their position. The only thing that will secure the alleviation of our misery and our wage slavery is the propagation of the principles of socialism and the building up of a class-conscious socialist party prepared to wrest at the earliest possible moment the whole powers of government from the hands of those who at present control them. When a strong socialist party is organised, then the capitalists will be only too ready to offer and to give each and all of those palliatives as a sop to the growing socialist forces in the country. We have therefore to recognise all the time that it is only possible to secure any real benefit for the people when the people themselves become class conscious, when behind the socialists in Parliament and on other bodies there stands a solid phalanx of men clear in their knowledge of socialism and clear in their knowledge that the only way to secure the socialist commonwealth of the future is to depend upon the efforts of themselves and those who have the same class conscious opinions. Therefore, we have no palliative programme. The only palliative we shall ever secure is the socialist society of the future, gained by fighting uncompromisingly at all times and in every season. It was a very interesting editorial, and of course you'll notice that there have been changes in the party position on this matter since 1906 when that was written. But on the other hand, it was a very solid basis at a time when they didn't have Labour governments to point to show the futility of reformism. It was on the matter of the use of Parliament to secure reforms versus the use of Parliament for the purpose of social revolution, then, that the possibilists and the impossibilists were compelled to stand on opposite sides within the SDF. Now, the two sides were hardly equal. On the one side were at the most 300 or 400 impossibilists who urged the Federation not to seek progress at the expense of compromise. Directly opposing them was the majority of the Federation's membership of approximately 9,000. There were the Lancashire Trade Unionists, who favoured a broader, less theoretically based movement. There were most of the leaders of the SDF who favoured some kind of unity with the Independent Labour Party. There was somebody who had a great influence amongst a number of members at the time of the possibilist-impossibilist split, a Russian Jewish emigre who had joined the SDF in 1895 called Theodor Rothstein, later to become a prominent member of the Communist Party. And he was soon criticising it for what he called its fossilised academism. And you can find the article in the theoretical journal of the SDF called Social Democrat, volume 4, 1900. In defence of their anti-impossibilism, they could quote the words of Frederick Engels, whose distaste for what he saw as the dogmatic purity of groups like the SDF was well known. In 1891, he wrote to Sorge of the British Marxists that, and I quote, "People who pass as orthodox Marxists have turned their ideas of movement into a fixed dogma to be learnt by heart and appear as pure sects." The alternative to the clear theoretical principles which Engels disparaged as fixed dogma were the politically pragmatic social democratic parties which were emerging in Europe in the last decades of the 19th century, and into which the SDF was eventually to be absorbed, which was to grow out of this the Second International and all of the consequences of reformism and the setbacks for the socialist movement. So by the turn of the century, there were clear signs that the SDF was ready for theoretical compromise. And the surprising thing is not that one section of the Federation revolted, but the ease with which they established the established theory was changed in order to dismiss the non-compromisers as impossibilists. Now I want to go on to look at what actually happened, how the Socialist Party of Great Britain originated. According to W.S. German, writing in The Socialist in December 1906, I quote, "The Birmingham SDF conference in 1901 was practically the starting point of the movement dubbed Impossibilist by H. Quelch." Now, German was a London impossibilist who joined the Socialist Labour Party in 1903. The Socialist Labour Party were the Scottish impossibilists who broke away from the SDF a year earlier than the SBGB and were very much influenced by syndicalist ideas. Now, whilst German might be correct in stating that the first overt expression of impossibilist dissent was at the Birmingham conference in 1901, there are sources which show that a loosely organised impossibilist group had been in existence for some time before 1901. They are firstly the minutes of the Finsbury Park branch of the Social Democratic Federation, which show that from the late 1890s onwards, at least one branch of the Federation was very unhappy with certain unprincipled actions being taken by the Executive Committee. The minutes of other impossibilist-dominated branches may well indicate that they had similar views and were passing similar resolutions of protest at the same time, but so far I haven't at least been able to trace any of these. Nevertheless, the Finsbury branch minutes do demonstrate that there was a branch which was consistently attacking reformist compromise within the SDF as early as the mid-1890s. But there is another clue, which is that the shows that the impossibilists were very much organised in the London area. This is the minutes of an organisation called the North London Socialist Club, which was founded in the mid-1890s. Now, the minutes were recently discovered, I might say, by a very devout scholar in the Records Department of Islington Central Library. The minutes show that many of the men who were later to become prominent as impossibilists were playing leading roles in the North London Socialist Club for some years before 1901. An influential figure at the club was one of the members of the Finsbury Park branch, who was a terrible thorn in the side of the SDSEC, and he was a man who is either appropriately or inappropriately called Percy Friedberg. He was, until mid-1902, the leading London impossibilist. Now, it's probable to me that the club was used as a place where like-minded members of London branches could meet and discuss their dissatisfaction about changes in SDF policies. This source also provides another hitherto unknown fact, which is that it had previously been believed that the ideas of the American, Daniel De Leon, were introduced to the London Impossibilists after they had made contact with the Scottish Impossibilist group. But the minutes of the North London Socialist Club disclose that the London men had been ordering copies of De Leonist literature from the Socialist Labour Party in America from the mid-1890s onwards. Such literature was certainly not acceptable within the official activity of the SDF. It would have been banned. In fact, on several occasions, the EC of the SDF passed resolutions saying that De Leonist literature must not be bought by SDF branches. And it seems, therefore, that for some time before the Impossibilist split, there was a group of members who were attempting to examine new socialist ideas and different conceptions of Marxism. In fact, De Leon's ideas were to have more effect upon the principles of the SLP than they were ever to have upon the SPGB. But the fact was that they were being considered, and this shows that a process of theoretical reinterpretation was taking place. An additional indication of this is the fact that Jack Fitzgerald, a young London impossibilist, was organising classes in Marxian economics for the benefit of SDF members who were unacquainted with Marx's Capital. These were started in 1901. The leaders of the Federation certainly could not have liked the idea of this young Irishman in his early 20s, recently having come into the Social Democratic Federation, spreading around the works of Marx, which they were importing from the Kerr publishers in America, which previously had never been accepted within the SDF. The works of Marx were banned within the SDF as being what Hindman considered far too difficult and theoretically clumsy for English workers to ever consider. And here was this young, new member of the SDF coming in, running lectures, criticising the old SDF economic programme and putting forward the ideas of Marx. And so the minutes of the Finsbury Park branch, the minutes of the North London Socialist Club and the economics classes of Fitzgerald all show that the London Impossibilist movement had started before 1901. But at the Birmingham Conference in 1901, three Scottish impossibilists, Matheson, Yeats and Cotton, attacked the leaders of the SDF, and they attacked them for two reasons. Firstly, the leaders of the SDF, who had been delegates at the Second International, had supported the Kautsky resolution rather than the more principled resolution of Ged, the French impossibilist. And what was all this about? Well, the Kautsky resolution was about whether socialists ought to go into Parliament or not. And Ged moved a resolution saying that they should not. Kautsky moved a resolution saying they should not accept in cases of emergency, which the impossibilists saw as being quite correctly as being a bit of a swindle. Worse still, the Federation delegates had attacked Lafargue for his speech opposing Alexander Milleron's acceptance of the post of Minister of Commerce and Industry in the Waldeck-Rousseau government. And you can quite well understand them wanting to complain about it. Here was a man who was supposed to be the leader of the French Socialist Party accepting a post as Minister of Commerce and Industry in a government that had just been elected in France. And of course, they, when Lafargue got up and said this with a bit of a bloody cheek, they said the Federation's delegates told him off about it. The second thing was that the SDF's journal Justice had advised workers to vote for the Liberal candidates in elections in Battersea, Burnley and Northampton. And so the Impossibilists made clear their distaste for this kind of compromise, and they insisted that no socialist should take a post in a capitalist government. and that socialists should never urge workers to vote for the Liberal Party. The majority of delegates to the conference didn't care too much about this change in principle. They were more concerned with growth than direction, and the protests of the impossibilists had very little impact. After the Birmingham conference, the impossibilists began to organise both in London and in Scotland. The means of organising impossibilist agitation had developed independently and in different ways in the two centres. I quote from Fitzgerald's article on the subject in The Standard. He says, "In Scotland, it appears to have been organised, and its supporters worked in a regular faction. In London, however, no systematic course was followed." In the next 2 years, the pattern of the Scottish impossibilists organising themselves and favouring separation from the SDF, and the Londoners tending to be less organised and less inclined to secede, was to continue. Indeed, after the Scottish impossibilists formed the Socialist Labour Party in 1903, they abused the Londoners for their lack of defiance. Now, it's true that the London impossibilists were less willing to break away from the Federation than their Scottish comrades, and it's nevertheless, I would suggest, understandable that the London members, being much closer to the leadership and the mass of the membership of the Federation than were those who were hundreds of miles away from the sources of organisational power. So I think it was location rather than greater intensity of principle which led the Scottish impossibilists to contemplate revolt before the Londoners. The two groups first joined ranks at the Blackburn Conference in 1902. I hope this isn't excessive detail for anyone. At the conference in Blackburn, the Scottish nominated for the executive committee the most prominent London impossibilist, Percy Friedberg. And it was in Blackburn, according to German in his article, that, and I quote, "The officials and leaders of the SDF saw that the movement which was called impossibilist, an unholy Scotch current by them, bade fair to capture the SDF, inasmuch as it had spread to the provinces and London." It's interesting that German's article then suggested it started in Scotland. I would suggest that might not have been right. But after the conference, friendly relations were established between the Scottish and London impossibilists. According to Fitzgerald, they were united to secure, I quote, "the adoption of an uncompromising policy by the SDF." Friedberg was chosen to act as correspondent between the two groups. Another similarity as with a contemporary member by the same name. Now, Germans claim that the officials and leaders of the SDF became worried after Blackburn seems to be justified by their subsequent actions. The first move they made was made against a man called Geese. Yes, Geese. He was a London impossibilist speaker who was removed from the official lecture list appointing speakers for outdoor meetings, and presumably because he was making dissident statements from the SDF platform. He responded by resigning from the Federation. Now, if Geese was prosecuted... Yes, Geese. Very odd name, actually. But I checked that with all kinds of party members, including Hardy, to see if he ever knew this speaker called Geese and what he was saying, but I've yet to discover it, and I'm working on it. But if he was prosecuted for criticising the SDF in public, the next expulsion, that of Friedberg, was for merely expressing dissent internally. Friedberg's complaint was that the report of the Blackburn Conference, which appeared in Justice, contained some inaccuracies and left out some very important items of business. In short, the report omitted reference to impossibilist criticism which had been raised at the Blackburn Conference, in particular criticism of the man who all of the impossibilists collectively despised, and that was George Lansbury, for very good reasons. What Friedberg then did was he wrote a letter of correction to Justice, but it was refused publication. He then submitted his letter for publication in the New York Weekly People, which was a journal of the American Deleonist Socialist Labour Party. Now, he must have been aware that this was the newspaper which the impossibilists, especially in Scotland, were very sympathetic to. And when the publication of the letter was brought to the attention of the executive committee of the SDF, Friedberg was expelled for writing these letters of dissent in an opponent's journal. Now, it's questionable whether the Weekly People could be regarded as an opponent's journal. And even if it could, there existed no provision in the Federation's rules to prevent a member from writing letters to it. In other words, their rules were different from those of the SBGB. Now, Friedberg's branch, Finsbury Park, refused to accept the right of the executive to expel one of its members without the right of appeal to the membership as a whole. The branch refused to accept the expulsion, and the EC, glad of the opportunity to deal with one of the more notable dissident branches, dissolved the Finsbury Park branch. At the same time, the EC was dealing with the impossibilists in Scotland, and it secured the expulsion of one W. MacGregor on what appears to be a very spurious charge. Then, in 1903, came the Shoreditch Conference, which took place at a time when the impossibilists were in a very militant mood. Friedberg had become so militant that he emigrated to Spain before the conference took place. He later, incidentally, joined the Socialist Labour Party, and he left poor old Jack Fitzgerald to have to prepare the case and act as advocate for the Finsbury Park branch, which was a bit bad after he'd caused all the trouble fizzing off to Spain. Shortly before the conference, Edinburgh branch, that's of the SDF, of course, sent an ultimatum to the EC, threatening to withdraw from the Federation unless the conference abandoned the compromising policy which had been developing within the SDF. On April the 8th, 1903, the day before the commencement of the Shoreditch Conference, the first official meeting of London Impossibilists took place at the Hope Coffee Tavern in Finsbury Park. It's not still there. The meeting was attended by 15 SDF members, all but one of whom expressed dissent towards Federation policy. According to W.S. German's account of the meeting, and he was its secretary, they considered the Edinburgh ultimatum in order to decide whether the London Impossibilists would support it at conference. It was finally decided by 9 members out of 15 that secession would be premature and that the best course would be to hold a joint meeting of London and Scottish Impossibilists when the latter arrived down for the conference. At the conference, 2 severe blows were cast against the Impossibilists. First, an active Impossibilist, Yates of Leith Branch, was expelled for writing an article critical of the SDF in the journal published by the Scottish District Council of the SDF, called The Socialist. And secondly, the expulsion of Friedberg and his branch, Finsbury Park, was upheld. The joint meeting of London and Scottish Impossibilists took place at the Cock and Hoop Tavern, Mile End Road, on the evening of Sunday the 11th of April 1903. And this was the first and last occasion that the two groups were to formally meet. There were 2 accounts of what happened at the meeting, one coming from German, who subsequently joined the SLP, and the other coming from Fitzgerald, who subsequently joined the SPGB. So which one you wouldn't believe will have to depend on your own bias. German suggests that the meeting favoured the formation of a new party and set up a London committee comprising German, Hunter, Egar, Fitzgerald and Sims. When, in May 1903, the Scottish Impossibilists sent down a draft of a manifesto for the committee to endorse or amend, and to have German suggests that the London committee decided not to endorse it and to have nothing to do with the new Scottish party. According to Fitzgerald's account, which I'm inclined to believe less, I think, at the April the 11th meeting, Yates, the chief spokesman for the Scottish group, announced that the Scottish had for some time been preparing for the organisation of a new party and that the London Impossibilists were invited to join it. Fitzgerald claims that the London members were outraged at having not been told about this for all the time that it had been plotted by the Scottish, and that they were so outraged at not having been informed of the Scottish plans earlier that they refused to have anything to do with the new party. Well, whichever one of the men's memories served them best, the outcome of it all is certain. In May 1903, the majority of the Scottish Impossibilists left the SDF and formed the SLP. A few London Impossibilists joined them. They did actually have one branch going in London at the time, but most stayed in the SDF. Neither German's nor Fitzgerald's account of the division between the two groups of the Impossibilists tell the full story, because there were real political differences separating the Scottish and the London Impossibilists. The SLP was committed to a form of Deleonist industrial syndicalism, which had little appeal to the men who were to form the SPGB. I should say the men and the women, because surprisingly enough, there were some. By the summer of 1903, the London Impossibilists were more isolated than ever before. The growth of compromise had certainly not been halted by the secession of the Scots. In January 1903, Quelch stood as SDF candidate in the Dewsbury by-election and received 1,597 votes with the help of the local branch of the Independent Labour Party. Hindman was once again back in operation, and the Impossibilists could not forgive the arrogance of the leadership which had ousted Friedberg and his branch. And above all, the SDF was emphasising its minimum reform programme, its palliatives, more than ever. The London Impossibilists remained because they felt that there was nowhere else to go. It was the only socialist organisation. But they had no intention of accommodating themselves to the direction in which the Federation was going. So, at the 1904 conference held at St James's Hall, Burnley, a resolution was carried which called upon the London Impossibilists to apologise for engaging in disruptive tactics and supporting a group which left the party. The five branches which voted against the resolution, Battersea, Peckham and Dulwich, Wood Green, Central West Ham and Watford, were all in areas where the SPGB branches were to be formed within the next couple of years. Having carried such a general resolution, Quelch then made a speech specifying the two London Impossibilists who were the most offensive to the leadership, the ones he really wanted to get his claws into. And they were Jack Fitzgerald and H.J. Hawkins. H.J. Hawkins, incidentally, was a member of the London Trades Council, so they particularly objected to him because he carried a bit of weight. At the end of Quelch's attack, Dan Irving, the delegate for Burnley branch, who was later incidentally to become a Labour MP, moved that the two dissidents should be expelled from the party. And this was carried in the manner of a Stalinist Congress by 61 votes to 8. It wasn't coincidental that the two men selected for expulsion were both candidates for the executive committee, which was due to be elected at the conference. They couldn't stand as a result of their expulsion. It was later disclosed by Jack Kent, the only Impossibilist member of the 1904 Executive Committee, that Hindman and Quelch had been plotting to manipulate the delegations to the Burnley Conference so as to ensure the expulsion of the two Impossibilists who could have been serious rivals to them for seats on the EC. In May 1904, a protest committee of 88 members and ex-members of the SDF was formed. It published a statement expressing the case of the dissidents, and I'd like to quote from that statement because not many people have seen it. This is the statement of the protest committee, which was still within the SDF, against the SDF. It says, "Whilst based upon sound principles, the SDF at the commencement of its existence laid down no corresponding policy which should consistently give effect to those principles. Consequently, members' branches and the EC each formulated their own lines of action, with the consequence that contemporaneously with the growth of what was then described as the new trade unionism, an attempt was made to permeate and capture the trade union movement, which at that period, as now, was distinctly hostile to any action based upon the recognition of the class struggle. In 1897, this policy received the official sanction of the SDF. As a result of this endeavour to capture the trade union movement, which is definite neither in principle nor policy, trade unionism has managed to capture many of the prominent members of the SDF, who, becoming salaried servants of these organisations, have been compelled to preach the doctrines of trade unionism in place of social democracy as the means whereby the workers should secure their economic freedom." I should say that social democracy at that time was synonymous with what we would call revolutionary socialism. It was a term describing Marx's idea of socialism. "As another illustration of our lack of definite policy, we find that at one conference a policy of voting Tory was adopted in order to smash the Liberal Party, whilst at a later period, we who had urged the workers to smash the Liberals were in our turn inviting the workers to support certain Liberal candidates because they were opposed to the war in South Africa and in favour of certain peddling reforms at home. Yet these candidates were distinctly hostile to our fundamental principles. Further, we now have the question of the Labour Representation Committee, from which the SDF withdrew because of essential differences of principles. Yet while withdrawing nationally, we find that local branches, with the consent and the recommendation of the EC, are working with local committees affiliated to the LRC and pushing forward candidatures of men who are not socialists. That was a very clear explanation of their grievances. Other grievances are also mentioned: the undemocratic powers of the executive committee, the ownership and control of the Federation's press by a company which the membership didn't control, and the expulsion of members in an undemocratic manner. The stated aim of the protest committee was to establish, I quote, a class-conscious organisation imbued with the true democratic spirit, backed by a definitely avowed and unmistakable social democratic policy, unquote. Whether this might be established inside or outside the SDF remained unsaid at that time, probably because they hadn't made up their mind. Protesting within the SDF didn't turn out to be useful. Two more impossibilists were expelled for complaining. They were Martin Killick and Newman of Peckham Branch. On the 15th of May 1904, the protest committee organised a meeting in Battersea. The meeting resolved that it was necessary to form a new socialist party. A provisional committee was elected and was instructed to organise